Welcome into the Sports Objective Podcast, coming to you on Facebook Live as well as our YouTube channel. Jay and I were talking SEC football earlier this afternoon as we caught up with Steve Robertson of Mississippi State 24/7 site, Gene's Page. Now we're going to continue talking about the opening weekend in the SEC as we welcome in the play-by-play boys of the Tennessee Volunteers, Bob Kessling. Bob, welcome into the program.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you guys.
Absolutely. We appreciate you getting with us on such short notice to talk about this football season. What a crazy year it's been, and also the football season in general. The SEC beginning play this weekend across the board. And so just without any further ado, let's talk about just the elephant in the room. And what can you tell us as far as the Volunteers roster and where do things stand as it pertains to COVID-19 and positive tests, contact tracing, et cetera?
Well, I think they've had some ups and downs, some setbacks during the camp, but I think they've got everybody back on board now. I think that they're all ready to play, and they had a lot of folks out of practice today, so that's a good sign. So I don't think they'll use that as an excuse. They got some bumps and bruises, some guys that are banged up like you always do during preseason camp, but I think that they'll have a good roster, and they'll have 70 players ready to go and go to South Carolina tomorrow and get ready to play the Gamecocks. So I don't think that's a concern right now.
And, Bob, you know, we're finally here to game week, and I don't know if anybody of us could have predicted what the schedule is going to look like, when it was going to happen, but we made it here. What's the team's, I guess, mindset and the excitement level for, you know, for them to be playing and, you know, going against South Carolina?
Well, they've been through a lot, you know, all these testing and Zooms and all this stuff that they weren't used to. The social distancing, you know, being scolded about going to parties and hanging out with their friends. It's been kind of tough. And for them to go through this, you know, it's the practice schedule has been broken up. Instead of being able to practice, you know, 3 or 4 days in a row, they'll practice one day and be off maybe for 1 or 2 or 3. So it's been a disruptive camp. But I think now that you see the start line right here, I think they're all anxious. I think they're ready to play. And, you know, college football players, they want to play football, and they're going to get a chance Saturday night.
Bob, we were talking off the air right before we went live, and you and your broadcast team will be in Columbia as the Vols are taking on the Gamecocks at Williams-Brice Stadium. What can you tell us about what the setting will be like at that venue in terms of what's the capacity and how many fans are they letting in at USC?
Well, we've been told they're going to let about 25% of the stadium in. Of course, media area is really restricted. Our booth is restricted at the number of people we can have in it. And, of course, we've got to have plexiglass in between us. We've got to be socially distanced. And so it's going to be different. Our broadcast crew has to be tested now, just like the players, because we're going to be around them a little bit. We can't travel with the team. We got to travel separately. But, you know, at first we thought we're going to have to do the games here in a studio off a monitor. But, you know, at least now we get to go to the game, so that'll be different. So, you know, it's one of those things, you just take it every day. Just what's going to get you through the day, and then figure out where you're going to go tomorrow. And that's kind of the way the players have been, and that's kind of the way we are. We're just grateful we're getting a chance to call games and do games, and we'll do whatever they tell us to do.
And Bob, this whole year's going to be different, and we're already in week one. We don't even know what's going to happen down the road. Mm-hmm. And you look at the roster, and I think, you know, SEC depth is always so important, but especially this year. How do you think the recruiting's gone and the development as far as the depth goes with the Vols?
Well, you know, they've done very well recruiting. As you guys have followed, probably Jeremy Pruitt, one of his strong points is as a recruiter, and everybody on his staff better be a good recruiter. So they think they've stockpiled some talent. They're pretty much too deep in the offensive line. Still waiting to hear on Cade Maves, whether he's going to be eligible or not. That's still in the SEC office's hands. They got 4 quarterbacks. All 4 could play. They think they got a couple of good running backs. Defense, they're too deep in the defensive line, and they've got 4 linebackers in the middle they think can play. So, you know, they've restocked the cupboard pretty well. But I think you hit it on the head. Depth this year is going to be more important than any other year, because you don't know, maybe on Thursday suddenly they tell you your two starting linebackers can't play this week. So who do you got? Well, those next guys better be ready to play. So Tennessee does a good job of getting the backups a lot of reps. That's always what they've done. So really, in most practices, the third and fourth team gets as many reps. And I'm not, you know, it might be on a separate field or in a separate setting, but they're still going through the same reps that the start, you know, first and second team are doing. So they should know what to do if their number's called, and that's the whole reason they practice the way they do.
Bob, we talk about, and Jay, you kind of alluded to the recruiting and how well Jeremy Pruitt and his staff have recruited. Jeremy Pruitt was just, I saw the news today as far as his contract extension, having 2 years tacked on to what already went through 2023, now 2025, and what a $400,000 raise as well. So a lot of folks are in approval of everything that's going on there on Rocky Top, going from 5 wins to 8 wins to now hopefully more.
Yeah, and I think it's just a vote of confidence. And I think one thing Philip Fulmer did when he came in as the athletic director, his whole goal was to establish continuity and some stability in the program. And, you know, Tennessee had gone through a lot of coaches in just a short period of time. And as you guys know, anytime you change coaches, it kind of rocks your program a little bit. Doesn't matter who you're bringing in or what kind of upgrade you think it might be. Your program still takes a hit for a year or two to get kind of back on track and let that coach get his players and his staff and all those type things in place. So, you know, Philip Fulmer hired Jeremy Pruitt. He's got a lot of faith in him. He thinks he's the guy for the job. And so this new contract extension, I think, is just, you know, Philip's an old football coach, so he knows how important recruiting is and how important stability is. And so this might have been the old football coach in him a little bit to make sure that Coach Pruitt understands he's, you know, liked here. He's been rewarded for building this program. And now, you know, with this contract, though, they expect him to take it to the next level. So that's the next goal for Jeremy.
And Bob, I was going to ask you, that was going to be my question. How close do you think they are to, you know, to winning or competing for the SEC East and getting back to that level?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. I don't think they're going to be a single game this year that they're going to go into thinking they can't win it.
Yeah.
And so that tells you right there that they're closer than they were last year and a lot closer than they were 2 years ago. Now, are they good enough to beat Florida and Georgia and Alabama and those folks? I don't know. You know, they had really played a big time catch up with both of those talent wise. But I think they showed last year that they could stay in toe to toe with most of the teams in this conference. And I think now they think with the experience they have, and especially when you got a good offensive line, they think that they can stand toe to toe with most of the good teams in this conference. Now, they've got to do is go out and do it. You know, they won their last 6 games to close out the season. Now, some of those wins weren't the prettiest, and they didn't dominate the other team maybe, but they figured out a way to get a goal line stand against Kentucky in the fourth quarter. They figured out a way to recover an onside kick against Indiana and go down and score. A couple of years ago, they probably wouldn't have won those games, but they did win them. And I think now they're learning how to win, and I think that's a big step for this program. So now they got to carry it into this year. They've got to try and make it 7 straight on Saturday night when they go up against South Carolina. So that's the next goal.
Before we talk about the schedule as a whole, I wanted to focus in on Saturday's matchup with the Gamecocks. The Vols ranked 16th. They're a 3.5-point road favorite in that one with South Carolina. Will Muschamp is obviously in a situation. It's always a must-win year in the SEC, I guess you could say, but he's really feeling some heat in Columbia, made a coordinator change on offense prior to this season. So with Mike Bobo coming in, after being let go at Colorado State. And so what's your take on this one between the Vols and Gamecocks?
Well, you're right. South Carolina just had a really disappointing year last season. And it kind of started when Tennessee really blew them out in the second half of the game here, outscoring them 24-0 to go on to win that game. And Carolina just kind of lost its stinger after that. You know, Mike Bobo is going to bring the old offense from Georgia. There's going to be a lot of play action stuff. You know, I think it's interesting. Everybody's talking about he brought his quarterback, Colin Hill, with him, a graduate a transfer now, but he also brought his fullback with him. He's a guy that had already graduated from Colorado State. He's got a civil engineering degree, but Bobo convinced him to come. And, you know, a lot of teams aren't even playing a fullback. But if you look at the old Georgia offense that Bobo used to run under Mark Richt, you know, it was a lot of play action, giving, you know, faking it to the fullback, or the fullback was a lead blocker. And so we'll see a lot of that on Saturday night. You know, their front seven is really good. And on defense, I mean, they've got veteran guys in the defensive line. They've got Ernest Jones, who might be one of the best linebackers in the league. So I think they'll be pretty rock solid on defense. But, you know, their offense last year just kept putting them in so many bad situations that it was really hard for them. So they're hoping to have better offense, and that's why you bring in a guy like Bobo to run the offense.
Yeah, and Bob, you know, a couple questions about this game is, you know, first of all, any matchups or areas of concern that, you know, you would want to highlight in this ballgame for Tennessee, that they have to win that area, they're going to win this game? And also, I want to get your take on just how it's going to be, you know, in a road atmosphere where there still will be, you know, if they have 25% capacity, there is going to be that noise. But how do you think it's going to be for the team playing on the road where it's usually hostile and it's not going to be that way now?
Yeah, you know, it should help the offense because the you know, the fans won't be screaming and yelling when Tennessee's got the ball on offense. So they should be able to communicate a little bit better. The one area of concern for Tennessee is that, you know, they lost two really productive wide receivers last year in Marquez Callaway and Juwan Jennings. And now they got to find somebody to take their place and somebody to get that production back up. So they got, you know, Josh Palmer, who was really the second leading receiver on the team last year. So he's a guy that should have another good season, but they're going to have to rely on some freshmen to step up and make plays. And, you know, some of those freshmen have missed a lot of time and haven't had the benefit of a true training camp. So we'll see if those guys are ready to play. They've got speed. And so, you know, Hyatt and Weidman have got speed. They've got all the talent you want, but they're not used to, you know, playing against SEC secondaries yet. So they'll get a baptism on Saturday night at South Carolina. But I think that's one of the key parts of the game. If Tennessee can't throw the ball, then South Carolina is just going to put seven in the box and tell you, we're not going to let you run it. So you got to figure out some way to throw it to those wide receivers, and we'll see if they can make plays. To me, that's the biggest matchup for Tennessee in the game. Can their wide receivers be productive and make plays?
Bob, just looking at the ball schedule overall, as we sit here on September 24th, you have five opponents that are currently ranked in the top 10. You have, of course, Georgia, Alabama, Auburn, Florida, in addition to Texas A&M, and you also have Kentucky, who's ranked in the top 25. So I think out of those top 10 matchups, or what right now would be top 10 matchups, three of those are in Knoxville. So talk about the schedule as a whole and your take on it.
Well, I think every team in the conference is going to have a challenge when you're playing 10 conference games. And, you know, nobody has ever done this before. And, you know, I remember back in the day when you used to play six conference games and the SEC coaches were screaming bloody murder when they went to eight. And nobody wants to go to nine, and they've voiced that. And now suddenly here we're going to 10. So I think it's going to be a challenge. I think one of the things I'm going to be interested to watch is the conditioning of these teams in the fourth quarter in a slug it out SEC game, a conference game. How are these teams going to hold up after they've been beating on each other for three quarters? Who's going to have it left in the tank? And so that's where the depth, as we guys mentioned before, but I think also the lack of scrimmaging, the lack of practice, the lack of hitting and bringing guys to the ground, you know, they haven't done much of that. And so now suddenly they're going to be tackling guys for 60 minutes, and that weighs on your body physically. So I'm going to be really interesting to see how these teams perform and what they got left in the fourth quarter. And then you start doing it week after week after week after week. And I think this is going to be a challenge. I think it's going to really determine who indeed is the true champion of the SEC, who's standing at the end of the year. I don't see anybody going through this thing undefeated. I just don't see how they can do it. And there might not many teams that get through with only two losses. We'll see. But I do think it's going to be very interesting how the coaches and the teams approach this season, because right now it's kind of an unknown for a lot of things that they're doing. So, but the bottom line is, we'll go right back to it. They are getting a chance to play, and that's exactly what everybody wanted.
And Bob, do you know from just talking with Coach Pruitt, has he been reaching out to other coaches to see how they've been handling this situation and how they've been preparing, or are they just focusing on themselves? How have they been kind of game planning the past 4 or 5 months?
Now, do you really think that the other coaches are going to share information?
No, not in the SEC.
No. But, you know, basically, what they've shared or tried to share, the coaches, is information on how you doing this, how you practicing, how you doing the Zoom stuff, and how you doing this. And I'm not sure that some of the schools are abiding by all the rules, the letter of the law. You know how coaches are. What's the rule? And let me see how far I can bend it or get to the very edge of it without going over. And I think that's what a lot of them are doing. So we'll see. I think it's really been fascinating to watch how they've been going through this COVID testing and how they've, tried to figure out who's available today to practice and who isn't available. And so now it's just a matter of, let's count heads, get them on the bus, and let's go over to South Carolina.
Speaking of counting heads, and we talked about the capacity down at Williams-Brice, how are things looking in Tennessee right now as far as the everything put in place by the governor there in Tennessee, and how many fans will the Vols be able to have at Neyland Stadium?
Well, they're telling us 25% capacity. And so right now they're making sure that they're got the tickets allotted. And, I think for a lot of schools, maybe they've had more people opt out, especially older people, than maybe they thought they would. And then some people maybe that are sitting between the 30s, suddenly their tickets that they're being assigned now are in the end zone. And some of those people have opted out. So, and some people have just decided, I don't want to fool with this. I'll just let you keep my money as a donation. So, I'll be interested to see the number of tickets. I'm sure that Tennessee will sell out the allotment of its tickets, and there'll be people clamoring it. You know, once they get it on the secondary market, then there'll be a lot of people that aren't season ticket holders that'll be anxious to get those tickets. But, it'll be 25% at Neyland Stadium. And, again, we'll see how that plays out.
And, Bob, just a question about the SEC. When you look at the West and the East, and you see teams in the past, who comes out of it, and the teams that are the best and that wins the championship. What's the biggest difference from the teams that, are top 10, top 5 in national championships and maybe the middle of the pack in the SEC? What's the biggest difference you see?
Depth in the offensive and defensive line. Yeah. The ability to withstand injuries there. The ability to have a really good backup tailback, that so when if your number one guy goes down, you don't miss a beat, running the ball, making sure you got a great quality backup quarterback. I mean, Alabama proved that, when Tagovailoa went out. I mean, they kept on rolling. So the depth is the biggest thing. And it's not just depth, it's quality depth. Alabama, they lose a middle linebacker and then they just bring in another All-American and stick him in there. And I think and LSU is the same way. LSU, I've always marveled at the athletes on the LSU football team for the past, 20 years. It seems like they've always got one of those rosters that you, when they get off the bus, you go, oh my gosh. So, but I think it's quality depth, and the good teams in this league, when they excel, it's because they can withstand issues and problems. And they really don't miss a beat when they hit adversity. And teams, when Tennessee's been building here, you lose a safety and suddenly your whole defense takes a step back. So you got to get to the point where, all right, you lose a safety and then your next guy steps up and your defense is still solid. That's the biggest difference, I think.
You know, Jay, I was thinking about it. you know, we're in our late 30s. And so when we were growing up in our childhood, it was always Tennessee and Florida, the battles with Philip Fulmer and Steve Spurrier, just seeing those matchups in the SEC East, which was the stronger side of the conference. In the recent years, it's, of course, been the West, but the East really seems to be getting back to maybe where it was. And it's moving in that direction for sure with Georgia, Florida, and Tennessee. And that's certainly not to leave out some other programs, but just, you know, the household names from the conference's roots.
Yeah, and I think this league is better when the Tennessees and the Auburns are better. And so when you throw them in there with Georgia and Florida and Alabama and LSU, that's pretty good league. And I think it just makes for better football on Saturday. It's better for the fans. I think it's better for recruiting. So Tennessee has been fighting hard to get back to where it was in the 90s under Coach Fulmer. And I think they're inching that way. I think they're getting better.
Bob, who's some of the best players? I mean, you've seen some outstanding players come through Tennessee. Who's some of the best ones you've had, you know, the pleasure to watch and get to know over there?
Well, Eric Berry's right up there as not only one of the best players, one of the best people. Jason Witten was absolutely incredible as a person and as a player. We got one right now, Trey Smith, who's about as good, outstanding young man as you ever want to meet. Casey Clawson, I mean, he was a road warrior as a quarterback. He's probably the most underrated quarterback that Tennessee's ever had. I mean, he went on the road and beat Alabama a couple of times and beat Florida. So he, you know, Casey was a guy that they called him the Iceman. He had ice in his veins when he made plays. Robert Meacham was a really good player. So, you know, Tennessee's been blessed to have outstanding players. They just, again, have not had this past several years, have not had the depth that some of these other teams have had. But we've had a bunch of good ones come through here.
Bob, I wanted to just kind of shift gears a little bit. I know you've been at Tennessee for an awfully long time. And John Ward is someone, unfortunately, we lost here a little over 2 years ago. So just talk about what he meant to you and how much you learned from him, whether you know, life in general or specifically, obviously, broadcasting.
Well, when I was a student here, I'd played football for a while, and then I just became a full-time student. And I got the opportunity. They were looking for somebody to be the film editor for the Bill Battle Show, which sounds like a pretty glorious title, but actually what it was back then, all the highlights were on film. And so when they would stop the camera, they'd put a little flash frame on it. And my job was to take a pair of scissors and then just clip out the little stretch of film like this and then glue everything back together. And that was being the film. I got paid $25 a game, and Ward said I was overpaid. And so that's how I got to know him, because I tried to be the best film editor in the SEC. And then there's a position open, and he knew I played football. So there was a position open to be his spotter. And so I sat next to him for 15 years as his spotter. And I was doing pregame and halftime and postgame stuff. But I was able to sit there. I mean, what a classroom, just to sit next to him and watch him do a game and learn how to do a game. I had a bunch of opportunities to go to some other schools, smaller schools in the area to call their games. And I turned those down because I thought that I would learn more just sitting next to Ward than I would be at some other school kind of floundering and, you know, maybe not having much success as the play-by-play guy. So that's what I did. And I was with him and I stayed with him until, I got the call from Jefferson Pilot to go to work for them doing the SEC game of the week for Jefferson Pilot. So, but yeah, John taught me a lot. He taught me about preparation. He taught me that he always used to tell us we'd go in the booth and it'd be, be the Tennessee-Alabama game or Tennessee-Auburn or the Sugar Bowl or whatever. And he would always tell us, I don't need you excited. I need you prepared. And I thought those were great words that, you know, you can be as geeked up for the game as you want, but if you're not prepared and prepared to do your job, then you're not going to be very good and you're going to fail. So, yeah, I'm indebted to him. He, you know, when he decided to step down, which would have been after the 98 national championship game, I didn't know if I was a candidate for this job or not. I hadn't sent any tapes in. I hadn't sent a resume in, hadn't applied for it. I didn't know, A, if I wanted it, and because there were more people in the business telling me, don't take this job because you don't want to be the guy that replaces the legend. You want to be the next guy. And Coach Dickey called me the Monday after John's last basketball game, and we started talking. It's the thing that made this job appealing. One, it's my school, and B, you get a chance to follow John. And the other thing was, people, I think, from my association with the Vol Network, and people at least knew who I was and they knew my name. So it wasn't like I was some foreign guy that they brought in, somebody, let's say, from Idaho or Nebraska. They knew nothing about the history of the SEC or about Tennessee football. So I think that made the transition a little bit easier. But I gave up a really good job doing Jefferson Pilot and doing the SEC Game of the Week, which is, when those things come open, you get 300 resumes the next day. But I took this job and haven't looked back. It's really worked out for me. And, when you're in this business, there's many times that you move your family because you get different jobs and you move them from one city to another. I've done a lot of things, from being a local radio sportscaster to being the TV anchor at the local TV station, Channel 10 here in town, to doing Jefferson Pilot and Fox Sports games and ESPN games and all these things, and now being the lead announcer on Tennessee games. And I haven't had to move my family one time. And so to me, that's the biggest blessing. I mean, my kids they all went to the same elementary school, the same middle school, and the same high school. And there are not many people that are in this business, because a lot of guys in this business were just kind of vagabonds. We just kind of go where the next opportunity is. So I've been blessed to be able to stay here in the same place and raise my family. And if you can't get excited about doing Tennessee football games, you ought to do something else.
Yeah, well, John Ward, not even being a Tennessee fan, but just being a college football fan, hearing his calls with so much passion in the touchdown Tennessee, it gives you goosebumps.
Yeah, well, he was special. He was, he was John was an interesting guy. He had his law degree, but he never practiced law. He got his law degree because he thought it would help him organize things and be better prepared. And he approached each broadcast like he was going to trial. I mean, he had notes and he had things stacked up perfectly. His main job, though, he owned his own advertising agency. And so he was all about marketing. He was all about branding. He was all about selling. And I think that when you listen to his broadcast, all of those traits and all of those skills came through, because he had that unique ability to, market the game. He knew what Tennessee fans wanted, and he gave it to them. And he had that little dramatic flair that for him, it worked out perfectly. For somebody else, it might have come off phony or just fake, but John played it perfectly. Like on a field goal, did he make it? He made it. I mean, he just had that little flair that the Tennessee fans love. So he was unique. He was gifted. That during his time, that you had Munson and you had Kaywood Ledford and you had Jack Crystal, and they were just some of those legendary announcers. And, let's face it, radio was in a much different time in those days. I mean, because everybody back then, everybody listened to the radio, because your games weren't on television. You might get one or two games a year. So your only way to connect with your team was to listen to the games on the radio. And so Ward and Munson and all those guys developed such a bond with their listeners, because it was just the two of them riding around in a car or maybe out on a tractor on a Saturday afternoon or sitting in a boat fishing. It was just John and that person. And so there was a tremendous bond that was developed for all of those guys. That's not the way it is anymore. I mean, because all the games are on television, and it's just different. I don't know if any announcer in this league has the type bond that those guys back in the 60s and the 70s had with their audience.
you talk about having the luxury of that longevity at one institution. At East Carolina University, we're very fortunate to have Jeff Charles, a guy who spent nearly 3.5 decades, who I'm sure you're well aware of. He was, of course, there, had been there about 9 years at that point in 95 when Peyton Manning was a sophomore and we played Tennessee, lost 27-7 in the season opener at Neyland Stadium. We're very fortunate. Jeff Charles has meant so much. He's the only guy that I've ever known from, because he's been there since I was, like, I guess 5 or 6 years old.
Yeah, he's a good one. He's a good one. So there, you know, there are a bunch of guys around the country that have been at their school for 20 or 30 years. You know, there are a bunch of guys in this league that suddenly you look at the Eli Goles and the Joe Fishers and a bunch of these guys have been, David Kellum at Ole Miss. I mean, a bunch of these guys have been around there with their team more than 20 years. So, you know, I've always made the point that good jobs don't come open very often, because the guys that had the good jobs usually hang on to them for a long time. So, but there's, you gotta be a little fortunate, gotta be a little lucky at the same time. But, I just am very fortunate, never take it for granted. And, just always enjoy being in the booth on Saturday.
Hey, and Bob, somebody else you've covered, and I just wanted to get your viewpoint on, you had, you know, worked with Pat Summitt, and covered the Lady Vols. What were some of the things you learned from her, and just kind of take us inside her program and how amazing she was as a person and as a coach?
You know, it's amazing with Pat. Nobody wanted to do their games. Nobody was going to the games. They were playing at Stokely Athletic Center. And back in the late 70s, a good crowd would maybe be 100 people. And so one of the local radio stations, WIVK, the station I was working for at the time, decided they were going to help give the Lady Vols a little boost. And so they were going to carry the games when they got to the AIEW at that time, AIEW tournament. And so John Ward and A.W. Davis, the regular men's broadcast team, and myself got to travel and do those games. And we eventually went up to Fordham up in New York. They didn't make it to the finals, but we got to the regional finals, I guess it was back then. But so we got to travel around and do things. So the next year, John decided there was just too much basketball. And so the Lady Vols kind of fell into my lap. Now, I was getting paid $15 a game to do them, and I had to pay gas out of that. So if we had road games, I lost money. But I didn't view it as doing women's basketball. I viewed it as doing SEC basketball. So I never treated it like it was women's basketball, if you know what I mean. I treated it as if it was big-time basketball, and I needed to treat it like this was the Final Four every single game. But doing that, I got to travel with the team. I got to travel with Pat. I got to be around her. I got to see how she worked. She was remarkable in terms, you know, she was just an old farm girl from Henrietta, Tennessee, and her dad was hard on her and pushed her. And, you know, one of those guys that never told her he loved her. He just expected her to kind of be one of the boys and be out there and milk the cows and bale the hay and all that kind of stuff. He knew he loved her. I mean, she knew he loved him, but he never said it, you know, so it was one of those things. But she just had this work ethic, and she just wanted to outwork you all the time. And she had the advantage at that time. Tennessee was one of the few schools that really gave a hoot about women's basketball. And if you remember at that time, the departments were divided. So the women had a whole separate department, and Bob Woodruff was the athletics director there, and he gave them enough money to let Pat, you know, start this program. And she got money and was able to get recruiting and got players in here. And suddenly Tennessee's going to the Final Four, it seems like, every year. But the one thing I respect about Pat Summitt, she got a really good platform to promote women's basketball. And she did that. And she fought a lot of battles for smaller schools that didn't have her platform in terms of equality, in terms of scholarships, in terms of Title IX issues, in terms of you know, same travel for men's and women's teams. You know, if the men are flying and taking charter airplanes, the women aren't bussing. They're going to be on a charter airplane too. And she fought a lot of those battles for other coaches around the country that maybe didn't have that voice. And I think that's why people respect Pat so much to this day is she just didn't say, well, it wasn't all about Pat Summitt. I mean, a lot of people say that the reason the Connecticut program took off so much is because Pat Summitt was willing to play him. And, you know, she had the most recognized, most publicized program in the country, and she would play anybody anytime. And so she gave a lot of credibility to Connecticut at that time when they didn't have much. And then Gino came up and give him credit because he would beat her. And then that just flamed the fire even more. And that fire was really good for women's basketball. So I just think she was one of those unique people that comes along once in a lifetime. And I was very fortunate to be around her. I got to call 6 of her 8 national championship games. So that was pretty special.
Bob, we really appreciate the conversation. Have really enjoyed it. Appreciate you being so generous with your time as we're right here about 48 hours from kickoff with balls traveling down to Columbia to take on the South Carolina Gamecocks. But we'd love to have you back on the show as the SEC race heats up later on in the season. But you and your broadcast team have a safe trip to Columbia. And before we let you go, tell where folks can follow you on social media if you're on social media, and then where they can tune into the game if they're not able to watch on the SEC network.
Yeah, well, I'm not on social media. That's one thing I don't do. And so you just go to utsports.com and the game will be streamed there. That's the easiest way. But it's on all the other, you know, tune ins and all those type things too. But you can find it, and we hope people listen and enjoy the game. I'm just looking forward to getting over there and getting this thing started. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Absolutely. Take care, Bob.
Okay, guys.
Really enjoyed the visit there with Bob Kessling, the longtime voice of the Tennessee Volunteers. Just tremendous interview. Not only talking college football, but there at the end talking about his mentor, John Ward, who anybody that has followed college football, they may not have necessarily known his name, John Ward, but they've heard his call very much like folks in this area. Whether you really are a fan of ACC basketball, we know Woody Durham's voice and Bob Harris of the Duke Blue Devils, and obviously folks in this area who are big fans of college football would know Jeff Charles' voice, even though they may not know his name.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing. It's amazing the longevity that he's had, and you know, and these other schools that have had people that you really, you know, like you said, Bubba, you grew up with Jeff Charles, you know, listening to him the whole time you've been alive, and same with so many Tennessee fans with Bob. So it's a special thing, and you know, obviously very talented. All these guys are, and Bob, you can just tell by the interview how strong his voice is and how much he cares about Tennessee.
Yeah, for sure. Really enjoyed that interview. Bob was a first-time guest, and really look forward to having him back on to talk some SEC football, maybe in, who knows, late October, early November, when the conference race is heating up. Speaking of heating up, and we're right here, I guess what, a little over 36 hours until kickoff for the Pirates, number 13 UCF coming to Dowdy-Ficklin Stadium, 12 noon kickoff, national television, Jay. Nationally televised on ABC due to Wake Forest and Notre Dame being postponed.
Yeah, it's a big game, and first game of the year is always huge. But with the platform and the opportunity for ECU to play an outstanding UCF team and have it be on national TV, you know, I think the team's going to come out there jacked up, and it's exciting to see, you know, the improvement they've made from year one to year two in Coach Houston's, you know, time. TCU. So I think everybody, all the fans are excited to see how the team performs. And you know, I think this team is a talented team. They're young. They're just going to have to, you know, make sure they execute and win the turnover battle. And, you know, if they do that, then they're going to have a chance.
Yeah, the money's been on the Knights, and that's not surprising. They opened as depending on where you looked, anywhere from a 23.5 to a 24.5 point favorite. And right now, I think it's, last I checked, either 27 or 27.5. So it's risen 3 to 4 points, depending on the source. And the over-under is 76.5. So they're expecting Holton Ahlers in the Pirate offense, which is certainly very explosive, as we saw in the Cincinnati and SMU games, as well as some others late last season. So we're really going to have to be clicking on all cylinders right out of the gates offensively and find a way for our very, very inexperienced and green defense to maybe force some field goals in the red zone and force some turnovers.
Yeah, I mean, and you don't want to say ball control, but the offense is going to have to control the clock. The defense will have to create turnovers. And you're right, when UCF gets in scoring positions, they've got to force them to field goals and not touchdowns. But, yeah, I mean, you look at the point spread and the over-under, and, you know, Vegas is thinking this is going to be a shootout and not a lot of defense. But if ECU's defense can stand up, that's going to be the key for them to stay in the ball game.
Yeah, we've heard Coach Houston talk on multiple occasions about how improved the running back room is. Last year you had Darius Penix, who went down in game two against Gardner Webb. And then you had Darius Mooney, who was expected to play, but he was really taking on a bigger role than he should have had to early on. But he did well with that, rushed for nearly 500 yards. And to show you how much deeper that room is, Jay, Demetrius Mooney, he has just, you know, between his COVID issues, from what I've heard, and then him missing practice time and that room getting so much better, I don't even think he's on the top four on the depth chart as we speak. So he's someone, Demetrius Mooney, I think will be certainly someone to keep an eye on going forward. But going into game one, he's not in the top four on the depth chart. And looking at the top four in the depth chart, I mean, you have Darius Penix, who's come back really strong after being able to play in the final couple games of last year after spending most of it on the shelf injured. And he's going to see some different roles this year from what I'm hearing. I think he has excellent hands out of the backfield. And you also have the grad transfer from Arkansas, Chase Hayden, who brings a lot to the table. And then you have the two freshmen who certainly bring different things. Rajee Harris out of South Carolina, he has some power and also runs very well. He's got nice speed. And then Keaton Mitchell, who really has speed from everything you hear, some of these scrimmages. He's had a 95-yard touchdown run, maybe a 50- or 60-yard touchdown run. You blow an assignment defensively, maybe don't fit things exactly right, and he can take it to the house in a hurry, kind of like Breon Allen did back in 2013 and 2014.
Yeah, both those freshmen I've watched film on them, and they've got a ton of talent, and they're going to get an opportunity this year. And, you know, when there's depth in a running back room, first of all, it's needed because, you know, it's a physical position, and then you've got to keep everybody fresh. But there's also going to be a lot of competition in there. It's going to make everybody better. And, you know, I think that's going to be a strength for ECU this year. And I think that's going to be an area where, you know, especially against teams like UCF, I mean, ECU is going to have to run the ball at a high level in order, you know, to be successful, because they've got to control the clock, but also they've got to keep, you know, they've got to have that threat of the run and the pass and have a balanced offense.
If you want to hear more breaking down the East Carolina matchup with number 13 UCF, tune in about an hour from now. We will be joined by Jason Beatty of Knights 24/7. He is their equivalent of Stephen Igo, so we'll talk to him. He does an excellent job, so we'll visit with Jason for the first 20 minutes or so, and then around 8:50, we will talk to the former defensive back for East Carolina, Kevin Monroe, played corner during the Steve Logan years as part of that 99 team that took down Miami in the Floyd Bowl, as Dave likes to call it, at Carter-Finley Stadium, where the Pirates rallied from a 23-3, a second-half deficit to win 27-23 against the ninth-ranked Hurricanes. But we will talk to Kevin Monroe, as he's the longtime color analyst on the Pirates Learfield IMG College Sports Network, and get Kevin's take. He's someone I really enjoy listening to any interview he does. He's a student of the game and really does a good job of breaking things down. And so we'll talk to Kevin right around 8:50 and take a look at this ECU-UCF matchup. But, Jay, if you don't have anything else, we'll go ahead and put a bow on this one, wrap it up. And we appreciate you tuning in, whether it was via Facebook Live or our YouTube channel. Be sure to like, follow, and subscribe. And for my co-host, Jay Sonhalter, I'm Bubba Rosenbaum. You have been listening and watching the Sports Objective Podcast. Until next time, as always, go Pirates!